This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Rachel Mealy. This Thursday, holiday for the country. Is the Prime Minister's plan to save jobs in the tourism sector the ticket Australia's economy needs to fly? And consent. It's a basic right. So why are so many men unable to understand it?
The experiences of myself, my team, and all young people around me was that their interaction and the prevalence of sexual harassment and assault among just the people I knew was too prevalent. It was basically unacceptable.
First today, you'd think cheap holidays would be good for travellers and good for the tourism sector. So what's to complain about? Airline bosses have come out in favour of the federal government's 800,000 half-price flights, saying it'll get planes stuck in the hangar back in the sky. But some in the travel industry, like travel agents, say there's nothing in it for them. And the package has reignited the debate over border closures, with big and small businesses warning the flights won't help if borders keep slamming shut. Stephanie Smale reports.
The federal government's tourism package has been given the big tick by airline chief Alan Joyce.
It's met all of our concerns and it's put in something that is truly comprehensive and I think gets us through to when the borders open. More importantly, I think it also is an incentive for the states to keep their borders open. And that's important because we can't keep on going through the yo-yo of the ups and downs of that.
The $1.2 billion package includes 800,000 half-price airfares from southern states to what were international tourism hotspots, including Queensland, Tasmania and the Northern Territory. It will include low-interest loans for small to medium tourism businesses too. Cairns-based tourism operator Alan Wallish runs boat tours to the Great Barrier Reef. His customer base shrank from 30,000 to 5,000 in the past 12 months. He says a low-interest loan would help him stay afloat until international tourism is back on deck.
Yeah, it gives me access to capital so that I can keep my staff employed, keep the machinery running, keep the operation running, keep our marketing going, etc.
He says the cheaper flights will help too, but he's wary that border closures in response to COVID outbreaks could undermine the plan.
We had a period just before Christmas there where all the borders were open. And we got flooded. We were actually, for the very first time, back to running 7 days a week. Then the Queensland border shut down, the Western Australian border shut down, South Australian border shut down, etc. Every time these borders shut down, people lose confidence and they stop flying or they get mucked around.
Tourism leaders in the world renowned Whitsundays have welcomed the cash injection too. But the CEO of Tourism Whitsundays, Tash Wheeler, is also worried about the prospect of more border closures.
It's not just Queensland. We need all of them to work together and find a solution rather than just closing borders shut and give the consumers around Australia some certainty. We know that $63 billion a year goes overseas and only $30 billion comes back in terms of travel spend. So there are enough people here in Australia to help all of our tourism regions around the country.
For those who were booking the flights and accommodation for those destinations, the package falls short. Flight Centre CEO Graham Screw Turner says half-price flights won't do much at all to help his part of the industry.
I don't think this is going to help at all, really. It is about the borders, keeping the domestic borders open and getting the international borders open as soon as possible, without quarantine, of course. So I don't know the answer, but I'm afraid this is not going to help our travel and tourism. 800,000 flights is not a lot in the domestic market. It's probably a couple of weeks of flights, I'd imagine.
The Queensland government denies its border policies are to blame for the tourism sector's struggles. The state's treasurer, Cameron Dick, has welcomed parts of the federal government's support package, but he's critical about the lack of discounted flights from Brisbane to other Queensland destinations.
Why can't Queenslanders be supported to travel to Queensland? Why can't they go to Cairns? Queenslanders want to back Queensland. That's why our economy is coming back and leading the pack nationally. People want to go in Brisbane and in the southeast. They want to go to Cairns, but this scheme says no. Instead, we have to go to places like Launceston or Murrimbula.
The Prime Minister Scott Morrison has defended the support package, arguing it will keep tourism businesses going until international airport terminals are busy again. He's echoed Alan Joyce's sentiment about the responsibility of states and territories to create travel certainty.
The strength and resilience of Australia to the virus builds each and every single day, which is why state premiers and chief ministers, as I've discussed with them on many occasions, can have growing confidence every day about not having to do the things they did have to do last year. This package is very dependent on keeping Australia open. To keep those jobs in all of those places, we need to keep Australia open.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, ending Stephanie Smale's report. Today's tourism support package has been announced just weeks before the federal government's JobKeeper wage subsidy comes to an end. The JobKeeper program, which provides financial support to businesses so they can pay workers, will cease on the 28th of March. Some industries have bounced back since the height of the pandemic and no longer need that assistance, but others are still struggling to find their feet. So what happens next? For more, I'm joined by our political reporter, Stephanie Boris. Stephanie, the multi-billion dollar JobKeeper program is coming to an end. How many people still rely on that support?
Well, this scheme began in late March last year, and the federal government has been offering cash to businesses, and they've been required to pass that money on to workers, meaning people were able to keep their jobs instead of being laid off. And at the height of the pandemic, there were more than 3.5 million employees receiving this wage subsidy. That's between the period of April to September. The government was hopeful to close the scheme actually in September of last year, but due to further COVID-19 outbreaks and the economy not bouncing back as quickly as hoped, it was extended until March this year. Now, the latest figures we have show that 1.5 million workers collected the wage subsidy between October and December last year. So it's still a pretty popular scheme.
The end is nigh, though. What are the concerns about that end?
Well, as you mentioned, it's due to end on March 28th, which is just over 2 weeks away. And we're hearing from certain sectors like tourism, hospitality and the arts saying that they'll have to let workers go if they don't get specific support past that date because they simply don't have enough revenue coming in order to be able to pay those workers. If we take a look at the data on the Treasury website, it says that 494,000 businesses applied for support in December. So that kind of gives you an indication as to how many businesses are still seeking support. Recently, we did hear from the Treasury Secretary, Stephen Kennedy. He was asked about how many jobs he believes will be lost when JobKeeper comes to an end. He wouldn't put a direct figure on it, but he did say he did not expect it to be many hundreds of thousands.
So aside from today's announcement, is any other additional support being offered?
Well, there's a range of very specific and smaller support schemes in place, very, very targeted though. So we have today's tourism announcement, as we've heard. However, we have just heard from the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, and he said while welcoming today's announcement, it's very selective and it doesn't actually go far enough.
There's nothing in this package for hotel operators. There's nothing in this package for those people, for example, who are tourism operators. So today's announcement, what it does is magnify the fact that in just a couple of weeks, the rug is about to be pulled from under those businesses.
So the question remains, though, what help is available past March? There are cheap loans available that are being guaranteed by the government to small and medium-sized businesses that are on JobKeeper. They can borrow up to $5 million. Now, while this will allow businesses to have more money, of course, it is borrowed money, and that's very different from a wage subsidy. The government has said for months now they just can't keep the JobKeeper scheme going. It's very expensive, and the government is arguing that now Australia is opening up domestically. At least support needs to be more targeted instead of being made available to all. It's just that everyone at the moment has a very different view on how much assistance should be offered depending on their circumstances.
Stephanie Boris in Canberra, thank you. The forced early closure of a power station at Yallourn in Victoria's Latrobe Valley has intensified the divisions between the energy sector and the federal government. Energy Australia says the plant's earlier than expected closure reflects the transition to renewable energy, but the federal government warns it'll hurt households. It comes amid international pressure for Australia to cut down on emissions after the European Parliament announced it'll raise taxes on imports from high-polluting countries. Catherine Gregory reports.
It's becoming a bit of a trend to ask, how do we manage the transition from coal to renewable energy? Still, Energy Australia's decision to close Victoria's oldest power plant, Yallourn, 4 years early by mid-2028, is a shock for its employees and the neighbouring community. Latrobe Council Mayor Sharon Gibson wants bipartisan assistance.
Work on how are we going to ensure that our community is not a basket case at the end of this.
But Energy Australia assures workers and government there will be new opportunities. It's building a 350-megawatt utility-scale battery by the end of 2026 to ensure energy storage as renewables enter the market, and points out this move is an inevitable part of a transition to cleaner energy. Kerry Schott, the chair of the Energy Security Board, says it's also more commercially viable.
So I've said before that more coal plants will close before their technical life is reached, and given the amount of renewables coming in and the increasing amount, those earlier closures become more likely.
But the federal government says households could end up paying more for less reliable electricity. Tony Wood from the Grattan Institute thinks a 7-year transition period should stop that and suggests the federal government could actually help out with a national framework that combines energy and climate policy.
Once the government puts in place its policy, then the industries or the investors can get on and deliver it at the lowest cost. So you turn an environmental problem into an economic challenge.
There's also mounting international pressure for the federal government to come up with a comprehensive emissions reduction plan after the European Union said it'll slap new tariffs on imports from countries like Australia which lack such a plan or are failing to reach the Paris Agreement objectives. It also threatens a free trade deal that Canberra has been trying to ratify with the European Union. Although not yet formalised, Mr Wood believes the announcement could be what Australia needs to make the change.
It then puts some incentive on countries like Australia or other countries that don't have a form of climate reduction policy to do so, because it doesn't make a lot of sense for our companies to be paying a tax to the Europeans. We'd be better off having the tax paid in Australia if we're going to have one.
But Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack dismisses suggestions Australia's not doing enough on climate policy.
Well, we have stepped up. We've got more rooftop solar per capita than anywhere else in the world. We lead the world as far as that. And we're making sure that we meet our international obligations. Said that all the way through, but what we'll do is we'll get to where we need to get as far as lowering emissions through technology, not through taxes.
He also points out Australia has bigger trade agreements beyond Europe. Data from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade says Australia exported $11.7 billion worth of goods to EU countries last financial year. That's predominantly coal, gold and other minerals and fuels. The Export Council of Australia's Arnold Hoyer says the carbon levy could negatively affect those industries.
That could potentially lead to a loss of about, $90 billion worth of exports.
He says the government needs to work with industry to prevent this happening.
In order for us to actually somehow price carbon ourselves, in line with the European approach. The thing is, it won't just be the Europeans. The US will follow, and potentially even China as well as Japan. In that context, ultimately, the global regime may actually impose something on us that we haven't actually planned for.
Arnold Hoyer, ending that report by Catherine Gregory. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Overseas now, US President Joe Biden has scored a major political victory after his mammoth stimulus bill passed its final legislative hurdle in the House of Representatives. The American Rescue Plan is worth almost $2.5 trillion and aims to turbocharge the economy and help millions of Americans impacted by the coronavirus crisis. Republicans denounced the package as bloated and unfocused. North America correspondent Barbara Miller filed this report.
The yeas are 220, the nays are 211. The motion is adopted.
I want to thank Speaker Pelosi and the House of Representatives today for passing the bill, and I will be signing into law shortly.
A significant victory for Jill Biden and a moment many Americans have been waiting for.
One sausage burrito, anything else for you?
That's it.
All right. $7.65, you can tap or insert right there.
Roxanne Rosmus has been hoping the stimulus bill will pass.
It will help us if there is relief for small businesses and in particular the restaurant facet of things.
Do you feel like you need help, a lot of help?
As a small business, absolutely, beyond, yeah. Would you like a receipt emailed or texted?
No, it's fine.
All right, you're good to remove.
The business is down 80% from this time a year ago, and like so many others, she's had to adapt.
We're actually a corporate catering company, so this takeout entity you're seeing here is actually a reaction of the pandemic. We've never had a storefront before, but because there's no corporate catering meetings going on, we're just trying to push our food out the window.
The American Rescue Plan includes money for small businesses. There are also direct payments of $1,800 for those earning under 100,000 Australian a year. There's an extension of unemployment benefits. There's money to speed up vaccine distribution to help schools open up again with COVID-safe measures in place and much more. After it got through the Senate, the plan's passage in the House was guaranteed, but the debate was still passionate.
This is nothing more than a trashy spending spree while doing nothing for those who have suffered the most from this China virus.
Lauren Boebert is a Republican representative from Colorado.
Why would Democrats push such a partisan, divisive, and frankly, unhelpful bill?
Not a single Republican backed the bill in the House or Senate. So what happened to the new president's aspirations to reach across the political divide? Sarah Binder is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution.
Another way to think about it, though, is how broadly bipartisan and popular is a measure outside the U.S. Congress. And by that measure, the plan is remarkably bipartisan in that it picks up support from the vast majority of Democrats, but also a large majority of Republicans, which in recent years is quite unusual for a piece of legislation coming out of the U.S. Congress.
How much of a coup is this for President Biden early on in his presidency?
I think this is pretty major for the president. It sets his administration off on the right foot, even if the road ahead is going to be probably pretty rocky to try to duplicate or replicate that on other big issues of the day.
President Biden is expected to sign the bill into law by the end of the week. This is Barbara Miller in Washington reporting for The World Today.
Once upon a time, the sun never set on the empire this family ruled. Now, the British royal family is becoming more associated with generating tabloid TV content than its pivotal place in world history. Meghan Markle's feud with the royal family seems to be getting worse. Caroline Winter reports.
It's the two-hour tell-all interview with Oprah that's rocked Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, the British royal family, and the world.
So we have in tandem the conversation of he won't be given security, he's not going to be given a title.
In the bombshell chat, the Duchess of Sussex said son Archie was denied his birthright, suggesting it was due to her biracial heritage. She also revealed that she was struggling with suicidal thoughts while living with the royal family. Repercussions have rippled across the Commonwealth.
I wasn't really surprised. I mean, I feel like racism is a really big and apparent thing in the world and in the UK.
Archie wasn't protected. They're not protected by the royal family. Absolute disgrace.
We're in this 21st century. We are not expecting such incidents of racism and bureaucracy to be happening.
What it should mean for us is that we must jump up and get rid of the Queen as the head of state. It's a disreputable, the monarchy is a disreputable institution.
But the matter of Archie's title goes back to King George V in 1917. According to British constitutional expert at the University College London, Bob Morris, a rule was created so princes could be no further than the grandchildren of the serving monarch. It was amended in 2012 to include Prince William's son, Prince George.
This is a matter of law. It has nothing to do with anybody's skin colour.
In her short statement, the Queen said the issues raised, particularly that of race, are concerning, and all matters have been taken seriously and will be addressed privately.
There will be changes, I'm sure. There will be a lot of soul-searching within the royal family.
Anna Whitelock is Professor of the History of Monarchy at the University of London.
This is going to be very much behind closed doors, and we're not going to see dramatic statements, dramatic changes. This is going to be about a family who are going to have to look at themselves and reflect on what's happened and what needs to happen and what needs to change.
She says time will tell if the public will accept whether this is a family matter or about the monarchy as an institution.
It's going to fuel the flames of those who think that really the monarchy is an outdated institution. It's one based on inherited white privilege. Those other people who are supportive of the monarchy and in particular supportive of the Queen see this as a betrayal in many ways of the Queen.
British journalist and presenter Piers Morgan falls into the latter. He's defended the comments he made earlier this week that he didn't believe the claims made by Meghan Markle.
I believe in freedom of speech. I believe in the right to be allowed to have an opinion. If people want to believe Meghan Markle, that's entirely their right. I don't believe almost anything that comes out of her mouth, and I think the damage she's done to the British monarchy and to the Queen at a time when Prince Philip is lying in hospital is enormous and frankly contemptible.
He stormed off the set of Good Morning Britain after being called out on air for criticising the pair.
I'm done with this.
No, no, no.
Sorry. No. Sorry.
So, do you know what? That's pathetic.
You can trash me, mate, but not my
own. No.
See you later.
I'm being...
ITV received more than 40,000 complaints and Morgan has now left the station. Meghan Markle has now lodged her own complaint with ITV over the presenter's comments, over concerns about how his words affect the issue of mental health.
Caroline Winter. Consent is a concept or a basic right we should all understand, but in recent times it's become increasingly clear that far too many men don't. Now the federal government has announced it'll be introducing new materials teaching respectful relationships into the curriculum from early primary school all the way to year 12. Alexia Atwood reports.
When Joyce Yu was studying medicine on university campus, sexual harassment was a major problem.
The experiences of myself, my team and all young people around me was that their interaction and the prevalence of sexual harassment and assault was too prevalent. It was basically unacceptable.
So, despite being a busy junior doctor, she found time to turn her anger into action. After intense research, she and a friend started Consent Labs, where they would travel around to schools and universities teaching what they thought was lacking. But what troubled her was that not everyone was interested in the service.
Universities is sort of the area that we started in because there was some more interest there. I think it was more recognised as an issue, whereas schools at that time were still very reluctant. They were worried, I think, about parents and also the school board and what was deemed appropriate.
But in the last few weeks, she's really noticed people are starting to wake up to the problem. After experiencing sexual assault herself, Chanel Contos started a petition from her bedroom in London. It initially called for consent to be taught from a younger age at Sydney's private schools, but the movement quickly gained traction across public schools and was spread to other states as well. Federal Education Minister Alan Tudge admitted he had no idea how much of a problem sexual assault in schools was until the petition started getting attention in the corridors of power.
I've been quite shocked by the number of stories that I've been hearing about and reading about.
This morning, he announced new curriculum materials are going to be introduced to better educate students about consent.
The federal government will also be launching new curriculum materials in the weeks ahead called a Respect Matters program. And it will go from prep all the way through to year 12.
But even if material is on offer in the national curriculum, schools can still choose to skip over it, meaning the way sexual education is taught across Australia is still a lottery.
I think it can and should be taught in schools.
Chanel Kontos's petition has also prompted change in Queensland. Education Minister Grace Grace has ordered an immediate review into the syllabus.
I have asked the Director General of the Department of Education to work across the sector. The specifics are we'll be examining respectful relationships education to see if it needs updating and is it adequate.
But for now, Joyce Yu is buoyed by the government taking the issue seriously and actually doing something about it.
It feels as if the people in power are finally listening. It does feel like voices of young people are actually being heard. And I think that in the past few weeks, there's been a lot of different comments from politicians or principals. And some of it has been quite, I would say, defensive almost.
Consent Lab co-founder Dr. Joyce Yu ending that report by Alexia Atwood. And that's all for the World Today team for this Thursday. Thanks for your company. Hope you can join us at the same time tomorrow. I'm Rachel Mealy. Stay safe and have a great afternoon.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Angela Voipierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
COVID-19 was expected to mutate slowly, but a year into the pandemic, we've lost track of how many new variants there are, and we're still working out whether the vaccines that were only just rolling out will be an effective shield against them.
Today on The Signal, we're taking stock of how COVID-19 is changing and what weapons we have against the newest versions of it. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.